and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. Simon Ward here again from the Triathlon Coach Swapcast, and I'm back with one of my favourite guests, and I know that you guys love him too. It's Dr. Dan Plews, all the way from New Zealand.
And originally from Yorkshire, of course.
Yeah, of
good
course.
To be back, Simon.
Yeah, lovely to, have you on the, lovely to have you on the show, Dan. It's always difficult.
I've lost track. Is this my first or second? Is this my first or second time? I know I've talked to you twice, but I think it could be my... because we had one malfunction when I had to do one recording twice, didn't we? So is it my third or... is it my second time or third time? I can't remember.
We did, me, you and Paul did one in Kona at your condo, if you remember. You cooked me dinner and fed me with low-carb, high-fat offerings.
And as you should.
Yeah, and then you and I did another call.
Yes.
Separately. So this is the third time you've been on, but the first time was a joint call with the prof.
Okay. So what, two and a half.
Yeah, two and a half. Yeah, but you've sort of broken away from the prof.
Yeah.
I have to have you on separately now. He's done one and a half. So when I get him back on, you'll be on level terms again.
Oh, there you go. We'll have to come on together again just so we're even.
Well, are you going to Kona?
Probably not. No. I would love to, but we've got we've got our second little one due end of August, early September. So It's kind of it's unlikely at the moment, but we'll see how mother and baby and things are in the home life before I make the decision. I've got plenty of reasons to be there because Terenzo Bazzoni, he's qualified. Tim Van Berkel, he qualified in Cairns a couple of weeks ago. And Jan Van Berkel's in great shape and he's got Ironman Zurich in end of July. So hopefully he'll qualify there and then I'll have three guys there, so it's definitely worthwhile, but we'll have to family first, as they say, so we'll have to see how things unfold in September.
Wow, Terenzo racing in Kona, that's every year we seem to have an amazing comeback story, don't we? You know, last year it was Matt Russell and Tim Don, this year it's Terenzo. It'll be great to see him back racing there.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, last year was pretty tough because he had the accident obviously and he wanted to get back and he was probably in the best form of his life before he had the accident when he went 9:59 in Taupo. And really, you know, I pretty much think that's the equivalent of running a sub 4 minute mile on a grass track. You know, it's
not impressive. not 9:59 surely.
Sorry, 7:59.
Yeah.
7:59. So yeah, he went 7:59 in Taupo and yeah, like I think that's people don't understand how unfast the New Zealand course is. It's like it's not flat. It's wood. It's like chip road surfaces. So it's pretty hard. Mm. So it's pretty impressive. So yeah, then unfortunately you had the accident and you just couldn't quite get things. Didn't really align for him, but I'm sure things will align a little bit better this year. I hope.
That will be an interesting conversation. I mean, you must have heard of Chris Froome. You know, he was in the apparently in the best shape of his life coming into the Tour de France, and then had that horrible accident last week. There was Terenzo, there was Tim Don, and you know, Tim was just before Kona, and then there was Matt during Kona. You know, in great shape, and then
not just coming off and having an accident, but having a serious accident that hospitalizes them and threatens their life. And, you know, the mental state of being in the great shape and then having to start all over again is a fascinating conversation into the sort of how the mind of an elite athlete works when they have to reset the goals.
Yeah, but I also think it does provide a bit of motivation as well, because when you kind of almost lose it and then you realize how much you want it a lot of the time. I think that a lot of that goes on in the mind of an athlete. So, yeah, we'll see. Time will tell.
Okay, well, it will be good to see him back there, and maybe you'll be there too. But anyway, let's talk about Kona in another year, 2018. Dan, you became the Ironman age group world champion. Not only that, but you set a new best time for age group was 8:24:36. You are, ironically, you beat the time set by Kyle Buckingham, who's coached by the prof, of course.
It's quite satisfying. Kyle.
Yeah, I'm sure he sent a bottle of champagne over.
I've got a story for that, because I actually, when I was running into the energy lab, Kyle was running out of the energy lab. And Prof was on the side of the road supporting Kyle just as me and him crossed.
Oh, right.
And I said, and I shouted out, I said, your record's going down, Kyle. And there you go. And it did. So it's a good job I didn't blow up, and it didn't.
In a Scott, of course, that he couldn't do anything about that. It's not like it was a race, because his time's already cast in stone. So there was no way he could change anything. Yeah. He just had to hope that he probably wanted you to. He wanted you to have a good race, but equally probably hoped you'd blow up or get a blister
exactly,
or something.
Yeah. I know. But at that point, I was feeling pretty good, and but you never know what could happen. It could have easily gone all wrong from there, and I could have walked home and not done it. But hey, thankfully, I managed to hold it together. So
it's easy to feel good going downhill into the energy lab, isn't it? Things can change very quickly at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think even on the way back up, I don't think I dropped much slower than a 4. I think I still held like 4:20s on the way back up, 4:20Ks. Mm. So I didn't actually. I just remember it being pretty hot at that point.
Maybe before we talk about this, what a lot of people don't know, Dan, is that you do have a bit of a backstory for triathlon, don't you? You're not just some mad scientist in from Yorkshire who's gone to New Zealand, tried out all these wacky training methods, and turned himself into a sub 8:30 Ironman triathlete. You were on the talent program for British Triathlon. You were at Loughborough. I seem to remember that you were at that point touted as the next big thing after Simon Lessing. Graham Moore used to get very excited about the dad, this guy Plews is coming along. He's going to be the next. He's going to be the next star.
Yeah, I mean that was when I was 15, very young, like 15, 16, 17. I was, I was pretty good then. And I think that's when Graham Moore and the like thought I could possibly be the next big thing. But I don't know. I guess I never really made that transition from when I was seven, that age until I was under 23. One of the things that really wrecked me was I was training for sprint distance at the time, and then they changed the age groups and it moved me from training to sprint distance all within the space of a year to being so I was supposed to be going, I was supposed to be top year junior training for sprint distance. And in that same year, I'd taken actually a year out. It was a gap year between between finishing my A-levels and doing my degree. And I decided to take a gap year because it was supposed to be my last year as a junior. And I thought, I could possibly, get a medal at the World Junior Championships in the sprint distance. But that same year, ITU World Triathlon decided to change the age groups around. So I became first year under 23 racing Olympic distance. And I think that's kind of what unraveled me, so to speak. And that was the end of that. And then I just never really quite got my momentum back. And you had the likes of Ollie Freeman and Will Clark and these guys who were just coming up and were way faster than me. And I never forget when Ollie Freeman sprinted by me when I was a junior. In fact, the first year under 23, he came by me in a super sprint in Home Pier Point. I'm like, who is this little kid? And at the time, I was like 18 and he must have been 14. And I'm like, what? So I think that's the... Yeah, I've always had a good background in triathlon. I've never, I've never stopped doing it, and I was pretty good. And of course, I was coached by you, Simon. So what's to Yeah, some good coaching in front of me as well.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thank you for that compliment. the small part that I played in your
yeah,
in
everyone
your
plays a part.
They
sure.
do. They do. That's right. So let's talk about Kona then. So you were there 2 or 3 years before. Was that right? You narrowly missed out on being age group champion then, I think.
No, I didn't narrowly miss out. I was there in 2015. That was my third ever Ironman. And that was a year when I don't even remember that year. It was really hot that year, brutally hot. And I actually came sixth in my age group.
Right.
But I think I was like 15 minutes off winning my age group. And the guy that won was, it was a German guy. I can't remember his name, but I was running into the energy lab or halfway down it, and he was running out, and he had this like camel, he was wearing running shorts and he had a camel pack on. And I thought, who's this guy who's just absolutely, he looks like he's just done a marathon run. I didn't even think he was in the race, but he ended up winning. He was turned out to win the whole age group. But yeah, and I think he was, I did that year, I did 9:11, and I think he did 8:52 or something like that. So yeah, about 20 minutes behind the overall age group win. But I would say that I think that's kind of what inspired me to want to go back and win and have it a crack. And I think I had that desire and burn in me then, because I knew, looking at the times, looking at what he did, knowing what I felt like I was capable of, I did. From that point on, I actually called my dad and I said, yeah, I think I can. My dad even reminded me, and he remembers me saying this to him, like, you know, a few days after the race, I said, you know, I think I can win this overall. And yeah, so, and that's kind of was from 2015 to 2018, a bit of a 3-year project.
When you have a 3-year project like that, do you start at the end? Did you think, right, in order to win this, I need to go 8:40 and then engineer backwards to where you were and work out how you were going to find that? I mean, if you'd done a 9:11 there, how you were going to find that extra 30 minutes?
Yeah, I think that's the way I work with all my coaching, all my athletes. And that's not just in triathlon, it's in any sport, is that I think you have to understand performance and you have to understand what performance looks like. And for example, in rowing, we're dealing with like world records, right? So, you know, what can a world record, what can they do in terms of individual performance of many aspects that makes them a world champion? So that would be, so if you're dealing with, just to go in rowing, so what could they do for a 250 meters? What is their maximal leg squat? What, you know, all these kind of little variables that make up training to kind of understand what you have to do. So it's kind of like, yeah, you do think of like what you have to do in terms of the overall goal, as in a 250 marathon, a 420 bike and a 55 minute swim.
Yeah.
You know, you do think about that, but then I would always take it back a level, saying, okay, so to do a 430, I'll have to have, you know, watts per kilo of around 3.6 watts per kilo. You know, in running, I'll have to be running at, you know, I have to run at 4 minute Ks with a heart rate 20 beats below my aerobic threshold, and I'll take it to the next level of thinking about it. So that's the kind of the way I would run my stats on performance.
How do you work out the watts per kilo from a particular time? Is there some sort of mathematical equation that anyone can use, or is it just your understanding of what other athletes do and then basing it
so,
on that?
So yeah, I mean, it's a bit of both. I mean, you can work it out mathematically if you have a flat course, and especially if you know your CDA, your coefficient of drag on the bike, you can actually then fully work it out. And Best Bike Split do a great job of calculating a lot of this for you if you put your power in what you think your CDA is. But like, I know that for a pro guy, for example, a price of entry for a pro triathlete, for a good pro triathlete in an Ironman, is 4 watts per kilo.
Yeah.
So, you know, so if you're thinking about age group wise, you know, 3.6 is within the realm. And yeah, so I just kind of came to that number off what I'd done before and how that looked, and also I had a little mass help in the kind of calculating what my CDA might be and stuff like that. So yeah, but I mean, I think I worked out that 4 watts per 3.6 watts per kilo would have put me in about a 4:45, but because of the conditions, it was about 15 minutes quicker. I was a little bit up as well.
So that 4 watts per kilo entry level for an Ironman Pro, that's their racing watts per kilo. That's not their FTP.
Yeah, racing watts per kilo. Yeah, that's what they would hold for an Ironman. Yeah.
That's interesting, actually, because I've heard that figure before. I think I chatted to Luke Bell a while ago, and, you know, I think he was saying his FTP was, no, his watts per kilo was 4, and that watts per kilo turns into about a 4.5 hour bike ride, doesn't it? If you can yeah. hit a 4, it's around a 4.5 hour bike ride for an Ironman.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And I like what you're saying about the engineering backwards and understanding what the top line performance is. So, you know, you want to go 250 for the marathon, you need to ride 440 for the bike and work it out from there. But and I've done this myself. It's we look at people and we say, okay, what are the limiters to somebody achieving that now? Is it physiological? Is it their, you know, is it their aerobic capacity? Is it their strength, or is it their flexibility? Is it their mobility? What's, you know, is it the strength around the calves that are stopping them running faster? Is it the power? Is it the fact that they're too tight in the hips? So you go right back to even having an assessment with a physio to see if the limiters are occurring biomechanically.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's all about understanding what those limits are. And you can also, I think you can build some training sessions around that. Like, for example, I kind of know that I have some routes and some circuits around me that give me a really good idea of what kind of shape I'm in. I was pretty confident I would run close to a 250 given the given some of the sessions that I'd done in the lead-in. And, you know, I've done it so much now, I can almost predict my run times within a couple of minutes based on the training that I've done just before it. And that's one of the beauties of one is monitoring and also not changing too much in the training you're doing a lot of the time. I've literally had a similar routine in my training since 2013, you know, the same kind of build up. And I think people tend to progress too fast and try and change things too much, whereas a little bit of the same sort of key sessions all the way through your program can be really beneficial because it gives you that guidance if you're going in the right direction.
Yes, there's a difference between performance and entertainment, isn't there? And
yes,
there's
exactly.
definitely a tendency, not just from athletes, but from coaches as well, to think that they need to entertain people by giving them different sessions each week. But actually, if you look at the performance level, a lot of those athletes like to have that standardization of sessions to see what the progress is.
Exactly, It's often a lot easier because it's easier for planning your day-to-day life, right? So,
Okay, so you've talked a lot about polarized training, and I know that you follow this approach for much of your training. We'll get on to how that changes maybe as you come up to your races. But where does your inspiration for polarized training come from? Is it from your own work? Is it from work you've done with the rowers in different sports, or do you follow the work of some other significant colleagues that you have around the world? Stephen Seeler, perhaps, who's done a lot of writing and work on this.
Yeah. Well, I guess the godfather of polarized training is Stephen Seeler, and he's probably he's a brilliant scientist and the person who's most vocal in the area of polarized training. And the birth of polarized training, it comes from the study of the best endurance athletes in the world, right? And then it comes from mostly rowers, Norwegian rowers. They found that they train this polarized fashion. For those that don't know what polarized means, it means that the most 80% of the trainers are low intensity, so below that first aerobic threshold, and then 20% of the training is a high intensity, so above the second, like the anaerobic threshold or the second threshold. And that means that we're very little like in the mid zone. Whereas you'll find that in contrast, a lot of athletes will do a lot in that mid zone. And the reason that happens is because it's kind of this area where you're going fast, but it's not that stressful. So you kind of, it feels quite nice because you feel like you're still doing a good amount of work, but it's also not hard enough to really make you squirm, so to speak. So that's where it comes from. And I think I've always been a believer in polarized training. But I also think it comes with the caveat that people have to think about it, where it's come from. And it's come from an event mostly, and it comes from events, and when the studies that have gone on since polarized training first developed, it's in sports that are an intensity above VO2 max. So they're at VO2 max or above like critical power. So that means that it's actually the race pace is actually quite high. So if you think about rowing, for example, over a 2K, 6 minutes, that is done well above critical power or second threshold, and it's closer to VO2 max intensity than anything else. So, and that's where it likely has its biggest benefits, because then the high intensity stuff is at more around the race pace, which isn't necessarily the case when it comes to 70.3 or Ironman type events. And that's where I think there's a bit of confusion, or where a few, we can get a bit of a blurred lines.
There's a couple of things I'd like to ask you about that then. You mentioned 80-20 there. I've heard Sela talking about that. That he refers to 80-20 as being the distribution of sessions. So 80% of your sessions are below that first turn point, and 20% of them above. And Matt Fitzgerald's written a book called 80-20, hasn't he? But in terms of total weekly duration, are we going to use the 90-10? Is that more appropriate when you're talking about actual hours or minutes of training?
Yeah, I mean, because it depends on how you're measuring it, really, as well. Like, if you're measuring, so if you say 90-10 in terms of actual distribution of the intensity as recorded on a device, say that's power or heart rate. Like, if you're doing 90-10 on heart rate, it probably will be more like 80-20. And like, the 80-20 is in terms of sessions, because you can't, what you can't do is, you can't just say it's in pure intensity, because if you measure it in heart rate, for example, you'll always have some time in between, because you can't go from one training zone to another training zone without being in the middle at some point. Uh-huh. So some training in the in-between is unavoidable. But I've spoken to Steven Sela about this as well, and he does think that if you're measuring it on a device, it would probably, especially heart rate, it's probably more like, 90-10.
Yeah. Okay. And then,
but to be honest with you, I went in there just to finish off on that. Like, I have never seen a 90-10 being in any of the athletes I've ever worked with. It's always more like 80-20, even in heart rate. So not 80-20, but it'll be more like 80. If you did it in heart rate, what I see mostly is kind of like 75, and then maybe 30, and then the rest made up of that kind of top end stuff. Because even though your heart rate might be saying that, say you're doing a set of short intervals, the actual work is much higher than what the heart rate is giving off,
right?
In terms of intensity.
So that's 70% below the first turn point, and then the remaining bit is above that. Some of it's in the sort of the mid zone, and some of it's in that sort of zone three. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, and the other question I had there then is, you talked about how polarized seems to work better for shorter, high-intensity endurance sports like rowing and what have you. But surely the 90% of training that we're doing, or the 80% of training that we're doing below that first turn point, the first turn point, the aerobic threshold, is perfect training, not just for the right intensity of longer distance triathlon, but also in terms of adapting to fat burning, because that's where most of that happens. Yeah.
Yeah. So we know that the point at where we're oxidizing the most fat is just below, is literally just below that first aerobic threshold. So, like, I don't know if anyone knows about training zones. So typically training zones are like level one, level two. So level two is the end of your endurance zone, and then you have level three lower, level three upper, which is kind of more of that tempo. Level four would be the threshold, and level five would be more like VO2 max type interval training. So we know that the VO2 max, we know that the highest fat oxidation occurs around the top end of, well, it is at the top end of level two. So just below, like right on the cusp of that threshold. And also, though, what's also really important around this, and this is where some of the math training and the health comes in, is that it has very little consequences in terms of sympathetic stress. So once you get past that aerobic threshold, the heart rate, you have like an increase in heart rate, and before that point it's more parasympathetic withdrawal. So that means you're not having any activation of sympathetic stress, whereas when you go past that threshold, you will get some sympathetic activation, which means that, you know, the autonomic nervous system is activated, which can then cause fatigue and autonomic nervous system fatigue, reductions in HRV, increases in fatigue. So I always try and explain to my athletes that once you pass that threshold, if you're doing an endurance session and you go past that threshold, that first aerobic threshold, you're actually giving your body unnecessary stress for no extra endurance gain. So that's where the polarized training and making sure your easy sessions are easy and your hard sessions are hard is really, really key. I think I read something the other day that was looking at Eliud Kipchoge and talking about, and he had this saying, and he says his motto is progress slowly but slowly. And I thought that's so cool. So what he means is that you progress your training slowly, but you also do it slowly. So yep. You train slowly, but you progress yep. it slowly. And I think that's a really good motto for everyone to take on board. And here's a guy who's probably, you know, he's running like six, seven minute miles in his training, and he can run sub 3 minute Ks for a marathon. So yeah, there you go.
I've got the document that he produced. I don't know if you've read it, about his 30 weeks training to that Berlin race. And
right.
You know, he does those long runs and he starts off running at six minutes per kilometer. I have trouble getting age group athletes to run at 5.5 to 6 minutes per kilometer. And you know, I doubt they'd any be within an hour of his marathon time, most of them. And yet he starts off by running slower than them. And then he progresses through that training. And it might only be the last 2K of a 20K, 30K run where he's really running hard.
Exactly.
His training volume varies very little. He says now that he doesn't really go above 80% effort very often. He prefers to keep all his hard efforts for racing. I do wonder how misleading that is for some people, because of course he has got a background of track running, and I think he was a 5K world record holder, so he has got that base, hasn't he, of speed and high intensity running to fall back on, and I guess he's never lost that, so he can perhaps afford to not train quite as hard now. But
I would agree with that. Like no two people are the same. And you know, and there's a prime example. He's evolved his training over the course of all of his years of doing that event. So, you know, the training that he's doing now would not be as effective if it wasn't had the precursor of all the training that he's done before it. So I think that's an important thing to remember. Like, I remember the men's pair, New Zealand men's pair for rowing. When I was working with them, they won a London Olympics, and then they won again at the Rio Olympics, world record holders. They were unbeaten in their event for 8 years, which is ridiculous. But like, so for 4 years before London, they trained so hard, like crazy, crazy hours. And then between London and Rio, they did very, very little training, but then they just did mostly high intensity. They did very short amounts of volume. You're talking like 12, 13 hour weeks, which is nothing for a professional rower, and they still had success, but the argument is there that I don't think they would have had that success if they hadn't had the 4 years that they had done before those, the shorter, more intense training. So I think you have to always, you can't just look at someone's training and it's like that old iceberg thing. You're just seeing the tip of the iceberg when you don't really know what's going on underneath.
Mark Foster's another example of that, isn't he? He famously talks about how he could still race at the highest level in the pool with only 15 or 20K of swimming, but he very rarely talked about all the years of swimming 60K a week that had built him the huge base of that iceberg you talk about.
And
then people would refer to, look, Mark Foster can swim like that with only 15K a week of swimming.
So going back to
what you said about stress on the body and stress hormones, for those people who perhaps aren't as up on heart rate variability, which we can come to a bit later, sympathetic nervous system's the fight or flight response. and parasympathetics to rest and digest. So what you're saying is that when you do the MAF training, something I'm a big advocate of, and that training slowly, you're not really activating too many stress hormones. So there's not as much cortisol and adrenaline released into the body. The recovery is not as bad. It doesn't have that sort of prolonged buildup of fatigue in the system, and that slow deterioration in the body if you don't back off. And that is, I know you're big on your health, longevity and performance, and for me that's a big issue with a lot of people, is that they spend most of their day in the sympathetic nervous system just through work and getting stressed out and the foods that they eat, and not enough time in parasympathetic nervous system, rest and digest. So if we're doing more training that's sympathetic nervous system related as well, it just creates a whole toxic environment, and they're not actually going to benefit from all the training they're doing.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So there's two key players. One is the type of training you do, and the other is the food and the high sugar foods, especially that most endurance athletes put in their body, that are also, highly cause inflammation and more sympathetic stress. So I think that those two are a concoction. And Prof. Paul Lawson and Phil Maffetone, they wrote a paper that was published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine called Fit But Unhealthy, and they talk about this very point, is that, just because an athlete's fit doesn't necessarily mean they're healthy. And I think there are certain aspects of Ironman triathlon and training for Ironman triathlon that aren't necessarily healthy, but I think there are also many things that can be done to mitigate any negative consequences without any adverse effects on your performance as well. So, I think people should have a pick up and try and find that article if they can.
Oh, well, we'll make a. I'll make a link to it on the show notes, so we'll be able to get that there. I'll also do a link to the Stephen Seeler research and some of your other blogs that relate to this. Let's get back to your. Oh, just one other question I had for you there on aerobic threshold and fat oxidation. Clearly, if you want to know your exact point of where you fractional utilization of fat is best, you're going to go into the lab and do a lab test and a gas analysis, but most people don't have that at their disposal. Stephen Seeler says that if you know your FTP, taking 80% of that will give you roughly the right point where you're going to oxidize fat, and if you can sort of train just below 80% of FTP, you'll probably be in the right zone. But that's fine for cycling, but what about for running and swimming? How can we understand where our best fat oxidation zone is?
Well, I would say 80% is a little bit high in my experience and what I've seen. I think I don't want to be too precise, but I do think 78%, like more like 78%.
Well, that's right. So if we take 80% and then work just below that, that'll be your 78%.
Yeah. So I would say that you'd want to be like just below 78%. But we know that generally people burn fat at a higher rate when running than cycling. But the rate of max. Well, so this term that you're referring to, the point of where we are oxidizing fat at its highest capacity, is called maximal fat oxidation. Mm-hmm. And generally maximal fat oxidation is around, but is around. Just around 80%, 75 to 80%, but it is around, more importantly, around where that aerobic threshold lies, and the reason being is because fat oxidation is highly dependent on something called non-esterified fatty acids, and non-esterified fatty acids are linked to sympathetic response. So if you become sympathetic, which is this we talked about, that you become more fight or flight, your heart, you, the intensity goes up, you have a sympathetic response that reduces the non-esterified fatty acids, which increases non-esterified fatty acids, which will then decrease your fat oxidation. So that's how it all lies and it all links. And also on this topic, I actually wrote me and my colleagues and my PhD students, we wrote a paper in the Journal of Frontiers that looked at normative values of fat oxidation, maximal fat oxidation, and fat max. So you can also link that to the show notes. And we go through like elite lean males, recreationally trained lean males, obese males, because everyone has different levels. So, and also there's a link on our website where we actually do a flow chart where you can guess what your maximal fat oxidation is based on some based on your habitual or your daily routine. So whether your type of diet you do, some of the type of training you do, because we can try and guess what your maximal fat oxidation is
based on the flowchart.
So that's on my endureiq.com, my website. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, there's a blog post that's called "What's Your Maximal Fat Oxidation." So I think maximal fat oxidation is the rate at where, I think I said this wrong in the previous sentence. Maximal fat oxidation is the point is the how your maximal rate of fat oxidation in grams per minute, whereas fat max is the point where maximal fat oxidation occurs.
Right. So if we're going to say for those people who don't have access to lab testing, roughly 75 to 80% of maximal heart rate in any of your sports. Yeah. Difficult probably to measure that as accurately in swimming because, you know, the heart rate monitors don't tend to work as well in the pool. So probably a level where you're in control of your breathing, where you're breathing bilaterally, and there's not too much stress really. So, and if we want to make it really simple for people, just follow the MAF method of training. You know, take 180 minus your age, breathe easily, get out of the pool or off the running track or off your bike feeling slightly guilty that you could have gone harder, and that's probably put you in the right fat burning zone.
Yeah, for sure. If it's an endurance based session and that's what you're trying to achieve, yeah, that's what you should definitely do.
Okay, let's go back to your training then, because it's great disappearing down some of these rabbit holes, but we need to get back on track with the training. So you're working backwards. You've identified the areas what you needed to work on. What did in your particular case? What were your limiters that you thought from getting down from 9:11 to that 8:40 that you thought you might need to win the age group world championships?
I think with me it was more a case of consistent chronic training load. I think that was my main thing, was just building up some consistent training. Especially on the bike, because I always struggled to get the amount of volume in that I felt was necessary. So so that was one. So I guess I couldn't really increase my volume. I think I did spend quite a lot of time doing some like high intensity intervals and, you know, time at around race pace. So that was kind of but it's basically to get the overall load up a lot, and I had some. I put some weeks aside where I could really just focus more a bit on training and get those hours up, and then that would kind of give me a nice step up to keep to then and then build the training load up again a bit more. That was the main thing for me, was more keeping that training load chronically high. And that's, you know, I wrote a blog where, you know, I averaged from Taupo to Kona, I averaged 21 hours of training a week, and there's a, you know, and that's how I think that was the main thing. There's no silver bullet. It's just like consistent hard training is always pays off.
That's Taupo's March, right?
Yeah.
So that's March to October. So we're up month 3 to month 10. So 7 months at 20 hours plus per week. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was more like 6 because I took the month off after Taupo. So.
Okay. Okay. There's an interesting point here is that if you're consistent with your training, all you have to do, I think, and this is, I think, where it's really pertinent for age groupers who are limited with time. If you don't get injured or ill, you can maintain consistent training. So in order not to, and this is how we work backwards as well, is in order not to get injured or ill, you need to have a robust framework and you need to not be stressing your body. So going back to that parasympathetic, sympathetic nervous system balance, the right sort of non-inflammatory sort of, you know, sugary foods, avoiding those. So making sure you set the frame, set the foundation for staying healthy, be consistent, and then take opportunities to push your fitness up with chosen weeks, maybe a week off on holiday, you know, a little training camp in the spring in if you're in Europe, going to Lanzarote or Mallorca, and then go back to your normal consistent training and then seek out other opportunities to push it up. Very similar to what Kipchoge talks about. If you're consistent, all you need to do are occasional occasional blocks to push your fitness up, and it will slowly, slowly increase, which is what we've just talked about, Kipchoge's approach.
Exactly, and that's the approach that I believe in. And I think, like, consistency is everything. Consistency of your training is the way to hit your goal, but the way to be consistent is to have the training right, and that's where the correct polarization comes in. That's why the correct sessions come in. You know, all those things are absolutely critical to, you know, not overtraining, not getting sick, not getting injured.
Do you have a traditional periodization program then? So, you know, you have your macrocycles and your microcycles, and you might do 3 weeks on and a recovery week, or do you have a hybrid based around family life and work?
Yeah, I'm pretty hybrid. I don't really plan recovery weeks because they just inevitably will happen at some point with work and family. So I don't really, I just try and surge through and I do some basic periodization, but I think I just go from that kind of idea from like specific to like non-specific training to more specific training. And I think, and that's, and when it comes to Ironman, if you think about what that means, is that it's almost the reverse of a normal periodized approach, because a normal periodized approach is you start with your endurance and you build in and you do more and more intensity and you do your speed, whereas an Ironman's not like that. It's almost the opposite, you know, because you're actually, the event in itself is long, it's at a low intensity. So if you think about what an Ironman intensity is, it's around that aerobic threshold. So it's kind of, I kind of take that approach with it more so.
Interestingly, and that works perfectly for the winter, of course, doesn't it? Because it's a lot kinder on your body and your mentality to be doing shorter training hours in the winter and then do the longer rides and runs when the weather's better. So the seasons are set up perfectly for Ironman preparation. I also think that periodization, if we go back to its origins in Eastern European training, was focused on one sport where you were weightlifting or sprinting, you were working on several different facets, and you could decide whether you were going to do concurrent or consecutive training plans. And I do wonder how much it's overplayed a bit in sort of multidiscipline sports like triathlon, and whether.
Yeah, and even if you look at the research to like traditional periodization, and you'll struggle to find any research to suggest that it's any better than just putting all the things in the mix all year round. I think all athletes have to. There's periods of an athlete's life, and you know, what I always think is like general conditioning, specific conditioning, and then competition phases. That's kind of how I think of things. But that general conditioning phase for some athletes is absolutely key, because training to train is so important. And that's, if you can't train properly because you're not fit enough to train properly, you're never going to make the progress that you need. And literally most of an athlete's life should be made up of training to train, you know, building, if they can, is building up the ability to train properly and recover properly. And I think that's even until 2018, like, I think finally 2018, I actually could train properly and train well every time, you know, go down into my garage and do a high intensity interval training session under a high load and still hit the numbers that I wanted to. And that to me is when you've really hit training to train properly, because your recoverability is so good that you can start really making inroads. And we see it even like I work with the New Zealand women's kayak team, and even some of those girls, like I see it all the time, like the improvements of the girls who have been doing it for years and years comes because they can just train more, and their ability, their train to train is so much better. So, yeah.
And probably for most recreational triathletes and endurance athletes that are listening to this, probably again, go back to Kipchoge's train slowly, slowly, or progress slowly, slowly, is if you try to do stuff too quickly, the body just can't absorb that training. So it, effectively a lot of that training is wasted if it's not being absorbed. So, you know, you it's like working for no money. Nobody would do that, but we choose to do it in our training. We wouldn't do it in our work life.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you're saying there about your own training periodization and taking rest weeks when you feel you need them, probably knowing what I know about you, Dan, and what you do with heart rate variability, is you're pretty in tune with your body. So I'd refer to this as recovery on demand. So you would know when your body's demanding recovery, and you would respond to it, and that would be confirmed by your heart rate variability data as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I would do my recovery more on a microcycle basis rather than a mesocycle basis as well. I didn't really plan recovery weeks. I'd just take, if I felt like I needed recovery, I'd do it more in the microcycle rather than go, okay, this week is going to be a whole recovery week. I'll just say, okay, I'm going to take a couple, this week I'm going to change things. I'm going to take a couple of days easy and just get myself back on track, because time's too short. I haven't got the time to, when you're busy and you're dealing with work and family, you can't say this whole week I'm going to have an easy week, because what happens if next week something happens and you have another easy week? I think it's too much of a chance. So I think for the athlete who's working and busy, I do think just dealing with them on that microcycle basis is a little better.
So let's say you decide to take a couple of days off. Do you have any markers that tell you whether you're ready to train, or do you just, you know, you get on the bike and you do your warm up and you think, actually, my legs feel tired today, I need another easy day? Or do you have some other markers? It's been an interesting thing for me to try and discover a way of perhaps letting somebody when they've recovered from a race, for instance. You know, can you do a vertical jump that tells you that you recovered?
I mean, one of the best markers of how well recovered people are is motivation to train. To be honest, obviously you can use HRV and stuff like this, but like motivation to train is absolutely key. And for me, it's more around that feeling of how bothered I can be and how motivated I am to do a session. If I really can't be bothered and I really don't want to do it, then that is a definite sign that I'm probably overdoing it a little bit. That's a really good, easy way to kind of figure it out.
Let me just ask, Dan, who coaches you? I mean, it's always interesting, again, to ask who coaches the coach, because you're a coach. You spend all your life writing programs and speaking to people and helping them adjust the training to get the performance. Who are you accountable to?
So in my build-up to Kona, I worked closely with a guy called Gordon Walker. So Gordon Walker's a Kiwi. He's the coach of the women's kayak team, but he also has a strong background in multi-sport. And he won the Coast to Coast in New Zealand maybe three times. So yeah, so he's actually won Halberg Coach of the Year three times in New Zealand for kayak. So he's an astounding mind and someone who I've learned a lot from. And it's also just someone who to be accountable to. And I know that, you know, he's made me do things and push me through certain situations where I would have actually said, no, that's too much, I'm too tired to do that. But he's pushed me through and eventually I've come right. And I think these are the times when I benefited the most from it. I think like as a coach and an athlete, when you're trying to coach yourself, you often can't see the wood through the trees. And having someone there to kind of just push you that little bit more and not do give you what you need rather than what you want is really important. No one should be self-coached. I just think it's the evolution of an athlete is that kind of when you're really young, the coach is more like a dad, you know, really strict guidelines. And then as you develop, that coaching relationship becomes, you know, kind of just a bit of a steer. And then eventually when you get to my level, it's more of a gentle tap in the right direction here and there. So that's who I worked with. And yeah, he's amazing. And I worked with him since 2013. Yeah.
Just before we go on to nutrition, in your training program there, you sort of briefly touched on it. What key sessions did you have in each discipline as you went through in that process from Taupo to Kona?
Didn't really have many key sessions in the pool. We did a lot of the same sort of, I swam in the same lane as Terenzo, and he just bombed up and down, and we'd try and do some things together. And we often did a set of 10 400s. which was kind of bread and butter.
10 400s at what pace were you swimming those at?
So we would try and go, we'd try and swim 5:15s to 5:20s and leaving on 5:30.
So, and in relation, is that critical swim speed for you or aerobic threshold?
No, it's not critical. I would say it's somewhere in between. I think it's just above real. It's kind of more like your Ironman pace, I guess.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Yeah, more like Ironman pace. So, because it's, I mean, it's a 4K main set, right? It's pretty big.
So, you got short rests on those then? So.
Yeah, yeah, so it'll be like 15, 20 seconds rest.
Right.
And then some of the main sessions on the bike. I was actually one of the things that I really did pick up before Kona was my I did some high intensity stuff, and I actually did some of the highest high intensity numbers that I've done ever before Kona. But I wouldn't really say they were my key sessions. My key sessions were some of the longer reps, like 3-4 times 30 minutes or 4 times 40 minutes. I even did like just 100 KTT and kind of like 20 watts above Ironman power and seeing what my heart rate would be. And then some of the runs would be like just some tempo off the bike, really. 8-1Ks I did. That was quite a key session before the race as well.
Okay. Let's talk about your nutrition then. Because obviously that goes hand in hand with this. You're a big advocate of low carb, high fat. Just tell me how that works while you're doing all of this training.
Yeah, so I think it's not a secret that I'm a big fan of the low carb, high fat approach. So that's when basically I try and keep my carbohydrate intake to under 130 grams per day. Try and do a lot of training on just fat, taking in little carbohydrates to really push the push my fat oxidation to as high a rate as possible. So that means if you've got a high maximal fat oxidation, you're using fats as a fuel in preference to carbohydrates, and you're sparing carbohydrates.
Is that what's called low carb or lowered carb?
That's low carb. That would be classified as low carb if you want to put it in a category. So there's ketogenic and then there's low carb. Ketogenic is typically less than 50 grams per day.
But 130
is kind of what I've found to be my optimal sweet spot.
Are you very critical in measuring this out then? Using scales?
Not anymore. Not in recent years. When I first started, I was. But I think that's really critical so you can learn the macronutrient content of different foods. And then after a while, you just know, and you can kind of get into your routine and you don't have to measure it so much. But yeah, everyone has to go through a period of time when they do that. I mean, I've been asked so many questions around this since Kona that I've actually built this course to explain the whole procedure and exactly what I do and how you should measure and when you should measure and how much you should take at certain times, what you should take during training, what you should take before different types of training sessions. So, because it's such a massive area and people don't really understand how to use it within the context of long distance triathlon.
So that's your Endure IQ course, is that right?
Yeah. So Endure IQ, it's an online education forum. Well, not a forum, but we have online education courses. So the first one that we built was called LDT 101, Long Distance Triathlon 101. And that's all about the art and science of low carbohydrate performance. So we take you through things like why having a high fat oxidation is important. We talk to you, we go through why this is actually important for health. And then we'll go through how to make that transition, what to do during training, what to do during races. And then also we have a module on how it's different for females versus males and how you should make those adaptations for different genders.
Okay, that sounds interesting. I'll take a look at that, and we will put a link to that on the show notes. When your next course is coming out, you can let me know about that and I'll share it with my group.
Yeah, for sure. The next course is going to be on training, so similar to this kind of concepts that we talked around today. Oh. So, and it's aimed at like coaches and athletes who just want to know a little bit more further educate themselves.
Okay, let's on the nutrition then. When you're eating your carbs, do you tend to take your carbs in throughout the day, or do you tend to front load them in with breakfast or backload them with your evening meal?
Now, when it comes to the carb intake, it's all around the timing of when you're so You can take them if you're going to do a high-intensity session. Some people can like take them before. There was a study that was brought out which showed that taking 60 grams of carbs just before high-intensity can be beneficial for an athlete on a low-carb diet. I typically never did that, but I've also had athletes where I've promoted that because it's been beneficial. So different people require different methods, I guess. I would typically take 20 grams just before I do a high-intensity session. In terms of the timing, what we know is it's all about trying to minimize any insulin spike throughout the day. Oh. And the way to do that is to have the carbs immediately after exercise, because that's when the muscle is most receptive to taking in new glucose, so you don't get an insulin spike. Because that's what, you know, that's what we're really after, and that's what you don't want to shut down that fat burning. So I would time my carbohydrates after exercise, and earlier in the day and less in the evening.
Is that all exercise then? Because, you know, you hear people coming back, they've been out for an easy run. Do they need to force carbs into their body then, or are you just doing it after your chosen high-intensity sessions for the day or the week?
Yeah, I do it after my higher training load sessions. I wouldn't necessarily do it if I go out for an easy hour morning run, you know, an hour run in the morning. I wouldn't necessarily put them in at that point. I do it after a pretty high load. That's a more, you do it more of a stressful session. And like if it's just a recovery day and I'm not really exercising at all, you know, I won't probably take in hardly. I'd be way lower in the carbs than I would on a normal day when I'm doing a higher training load.
Okay. But what about when you were during that period coming up to Kona and there was significantly more high-intensity training? Do you cycle your carbs then and have a bigger dosage per day, or are you still sticking to the 130 grams?
I guess 130 grams plus or minus 20 or 30 or whatever it would be, but it was still reasonably low. And I always found that the days that I might be higher, the next day I'll be a lot lower. So I think on average it would be – well – I know that on average it was around the 130, but like leading into Kona, I had a high training volume, but I wouldn't say it was necessarily massively high intensity. The key is under that circumstances is to get the right amount of calories, full stop, because you really don't want to be running into negative energy balance, and that's the most important thing. So I would make sure that I'd be adding more fats to my fuel. I'd be having more fat and energy during training. So I'd use the S-Fuels Ultra Drink, which is just pure medium-chain triglycerides and glutamine during training, and made sure that I just fuel with more fuel in general, but trying to keep within those same macronutrients guidelines.
Okay, so you're supplementing your fats with MCTs. What foods do you typically eat? I've seen some of the blur Instagram posts you've put about doing 200K rides and eating nothing but an avocado to get your fats. So obviously avocados are in there. What are the foods you're typically consuming?
Don't think I've ever put that on an Instagram post.
I'm fairly certain I saw that somewhere. Olive oil and an avocado. Or nuts and an avocado, surely.
So I've done some pretty long stuff on no food, but when I'm exercising, I have S-Fuels.
Right.
S-Fuels are the company that I work with, and we build them. And the products are designed for minimizing any spike in blood sugar, and the design, and they are a pure fat drink, a pure fat supplement. So they're like, they taste like a sports drink, but they're just made up of MCT, and they're made up of glutamine. So the glutamine's there to help with the gut integrity and the gut health, and then the MCT is bound to collagen. It's a sugar-free fat drink.
When you're not eating many carbs, your body still creates glycogen by breaking down fats. Is it gluconeogenesis that process?
Yeah, so it breaks down proteins mostly from gluconeogenesis to make new carbohydrates. But it can do it your body's pretty good at finding carbs from other sources. But also, like, gluconeogenesis is not a supply driven process. So that means that the more protein you eat, it doesn't mean that you just ramp up gluconeogenesis more and more and more to get more and more glucose. It's your body will only do it to a certain degree where it feels like it has enough. And in my opinion, one of the biggest mistakes. So that being said, what most athletes, then they get scared of having protein because they think they're going to have this gluconeogenesis and have too much carbs. But there's actually a study that's just been brought out in the Medicine and Exercise Sport and Science Journal that showed that athletes who are on a ketogenic low-carb diet have a higher protein requirement than those on a carbohydrate diet. And that's one of the things that I've always followed, is that I've never, ever restricted my protein. In fact, my diet is so high in protein. It's really, you know, I really do eat a lot of protein. And I think that's one of the reasons I've had a lot of success on the diet. And it's, and not having a lot of protein in your diet, as would be the guidelines of most low-carb ketogenic diets, is the way that you will not have success on the diet. So I think it's quite nice to actually have this study that's finally come out that's actually supported what I've just felt myself and done myself for a long period of time. And don't forget, like, most of the studies that promote low protein are done in epileptics, and they're quite the mostly clinical trials. So, you know, we're not dealing with athletes here. We're not dealing with people who are, you know, also stressing their bodies every day. So for me, gluconeogenesis is something that's talked about a lot, but it's not something that people really need to be concerned about.
When you're talking about having quite high levels of protein consumption, are you talking about more than 1.5 to 2 grams of per kilo per day, which is the standard recommended dosage for people training?
Yeah, I'm way more than that, more than that.
And that you don't find that's putting any extra strain on your kidneys or your liver or anything?
Well, none of my bloods or anything have ever come back of being suggestive of that. But I think it's a question of having the right proteins as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the guy called Stuart Phillips, who's the expert in, he is the world leading expert in protein research. And he says that those guidelines for protein intakes are way too low, particularly for athletes and particularly for people getting just general people and general people who are living just a normal life. Because protein turnover is the key to aging and longevity. And the two things that are important for protein turnover is firstly exercise and secondly how much protein you eat. So if you're an aging vegan, you're in a lot of trouble.
So actually, now that I'm 55, I actually need to be looking at increasing my protein intake, getting completely eliminating all of those refined sugars and processed foods, and reducing my carbohydrate consumption to give me longevity, and on top of longevity, then performance.
Yeah, there's a guy called Dr. Volta Longo has this fasting mimicking diet.
Yep.
And, you know, his suggestion is that as you get older, the best, he suggests that you should not have much protein in your diet. But like, if you look at, I would disagree with that. And his argument is that it's certain signals, one called mTOR, that's not good for, that's bad for aging. But I think the negative consequences of poor protein turnover far outweigh the negative consequences of that. But he also admits that as you get older, that protein requirement is necessary. So there you go.
Right. I know you've got to go shortly. I just got a couple more questions for you. Specifics for Kona. Give me a quick answer to this. How did you prepare for the heat there? Because obviously you were coming out of a New Zealand winter at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm fortunate that I work at a university and I have a heat chamber.
Right.
So, so I did a lot of work in the heat chamber and sauna.
I did this before Kona and before MDS. We did 5 sessions, 2 to 3 days apart, working on just trying to get used to the heat, really. And I definitely noticed a change. Do you have any specific protocols, or is it down to the individual and accessibility to facilities where you can mimic this?
Yeah, there's definitely some protocols that are in place. I would say that what you did is probably not enough chronic loading. I think you need to do a bit more than that consecutive days. But again, this is another thing that we're going to be, like Enduro IQ, we're going to have a course on preparing for the heat.
Yeah.
There's different stages of what's optimal. So you've got like passive heat, exercising in the heat, heat training camps and all this kind of thing. So there's more to the heat than just acclimatization. There's there's heat for just as a basic training stimulus as well. In fact, this morning, my PhD student is looking at some of the adaptations associated with training in a temperate climate versus training in the heat, and I'm one of the subjects as well. And he took, and I had some of half of my quad. Well, not half my quad. I had a good muscle biopsy this morning, which involved a rather large needle and good bit of my a chunk of my vastus lateralis taken out of my leg.
Nah, sounds wonderful. So yeah. I mean, I actually did a bit of sauna protocol as well, which is training for an hour without any liquid, and then sitting in the sauna for 3 times 10 minutes, where you can drink ad libitum. So you do a 10-minute interval, get out, have a cold shower, 5 minutes, dry off, go back in, and then over successive sessions, work up to continuous 30 minutes in the sauna after exercise. So those were my alternatives to when I was in the heat chamber. So I did do a bit more work. I felt really
45 minutes in the sauna before Kona. That's about as maximum as I can tolerate.
Okay. And that thing about heat there is some stuff out there now that's suggesting that training in the heat might be a good alternative to training at altitude. I don't know how, in terms of increasing blood volume rather than red blood cells. Have you done much on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've not done much about it myself. I'm aware of the research so the idea is that, you know, training in the heat increases blood plasma volume to large amounts, and then it enhances your aerobic endurance due to enhances in stroke volume, cardiac output and alike. But I think, and also it's the difficulty that we have with those studies is that you're also just increasing the training stress in general. So if you take someone who, you know, you're looking at people who have high heart rates, you know, you're doing 260 watts in a temperate condition, you're doing 260 watts in the heat, and then the person in the heat is just having a training harder. They're doing more training because the stress is harder. So the trick is to find a way to have two temperate group and a heat group where their training stress is the same, which is really hard to achieve, because then if you make the heat group go lighter, that's not the way you would typically train in the heat. So when I went to Kona on training camps, I wouldn't adjust my training. I wouldn't really adjust the watts I was trying to hold. I just accept that my heart rate was higher, and that was that. You know, that's just the way you roll. So yeah, it's an interesting one. But I think what's good about the heat is that it's just a much easier thing for people to do, because getting to altitude and really when it comes to altitude, it's really the train high, live low method that has been proven to be somewhat effective. And even that's not effective in everyone. So that's really hard to achieve.
Nutrition on race day. Did you change your nutrition at all in terms of the carbs that you were taking in? And if so, by how much?
Yeah, I took in normal carbs on race day.
So when nutritionists are recommending 50 to 60 grams of carbs per hour, there's also a lot of talk about training your body to get used to taking in the carbs and absorbing them, and that there's some trainability of the muscles to absorb, glycogen on the day. Did you have to do much of that before then, or is the body reasonably flexible and well adapted anyway?
Yeah, so that the training of the gut stuff is something that has never ever been proven in a research lab. There's one current opinion article written by Asuka Dukendrup and made the suggestion that this is a thing, but to be honest with you, I think it's purely just the marketing and Gatorade trying to make you have more of the product because they think you have to train it, you know, and then you have to use all their products in training as well as in racing. Right. But like, I have never taken, I didn't do any prep in terms of carbohydrates before racing, and I just take it on race day and I've been fine. I think when it comes to people who have sore stomachs, I think it's more to do with probably not getting too much stress, or the overall stress, which is affecting the endocrine system a little bit. It's affecting the, you know, the gut, the integrity in general. Just that's why people have trouble in the heat, because the overall stress is so high. So then your body just, you know, doesn't know what to do. So, and then you get an upset stomach. But I don't really think it's the fact that you don't know how to absorb a carbohydrate. Like, I think your body knows what to do with a carbohydrate.
Yeah, it's interesting that the whole fat adaptation thing is take, it's not about adapting to fat, because it seems like the body's pretty good at that. At least that's my understanding. It's removing the dependency on carbohydrates that we all have as endurance athletes. So teaching our body to do without the carbs. And when we introduce them, like you say, it knows perfectly well what to do with them. Now it's getting them back again.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, like carbohydrates are a pretty major macronutrient. And it's not like, even on a low carb diet, it's not like you're not eating any carbohydrates. Like your body's still seeing carbohydrates on a day-to-day basis. It's not like it's not seeing one single gram of carbohydrate in your body at all. It's still seeing them, but so it's not really that much of a shock. It's just I've never found it to be a problem. So
right, Dan, let's just wrap up. We've talked about how you do this, and clearly you're very, very engaged in the science world. Well, you're a leader in the science world. You're very, very engaged in what your body's telling you. You've got a lot of experience. You're a natural athlete and what have you. There'll be a lot of age group and recreational triathletes and endurance athletes listening to this podcast that will say, well, it's all right for him because of all of those things I've just reeled off. What about me? So what lessons, what tips can we give to our recreational athletes that perhaps can't manage 20 hours training a week, that maybe aren't even trying to go under 10 hours, they're just trying to finish their Ironman race, but want to make use of some of the stuff that we've talked about today?
I think one of the main things for me is that, like, even though I've had great success, I don't think I've ever taken it too seriously, in that I just really have always massively enjoyed training. And I think it's really important to enjoy the process. And if you have that in your mind and you enjoy the process, everything else will take care of itself. Like, you've really got to enjoy your training. You've got to love your training. But the main thing about being what we talked about earlier is, you know, being consistent. So consistency of training is absolutely everything. If you're just doing 10 hours a week and you can do back-to-back quality sessions, 10 hours a week, you know, eventually things will start to happen. And there is no quick fix in any of this. You have to be patient. You have to play the long game, and you have to do it week in, week out for a number of years before you start seeing the gains. And it's about being patient and patient, and it will eventually come.
What about the nutrition? Some simple tips there.
Avoid sugars is my main one. Avoid all simple refined sugars. I think that kind of human interference factor is always a great rule. So any foods that can't be developed by a community, don't put them in your mouth. And I think that's the easiest and simplest method that you can follow that will really have massive consequences towards your health, overall well-being and performance.
I had a chat with Phil Maffetone, and he said, you know, but I said to him, but what about treating yourself? He said, well, would you treat yourself with heroin? You know, would you say to yourself, you've been a good boy today, Simon, with that run. Here's a little line of heroin. You wouldn't, would you? He said, but sugar's a drug, just like heroin. I'm not sure if he was being a little too extreme there, but I think people got the message.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme. But yeah, I mean, there's other ways you can treat yourself with, you know, without putting that kind of sugar in mouth. There's plenty of other nice things in that you can eat.
Yeah. Well, listen, Dan, I know you've got to, I know you're an early riser, so you've got to get off to your bed. And that's really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to chat today. It's been great to catch up. We shouldn't leave it quite so long next time.
For sure not.
I will make a link to those articles you talked about, the Prof and the Maffetone article. If you can send me a link to that Fat Max calculator on your Endure IQ. If it's accessible, we'll do some references to the polarized Stephen Seeler stuff, and I will definitely refer to your Endure IQ course and let people know about that. And if you keep me posted on the next one, then we'll let everybody know too.
Will do. Awesome. No, thanks for having me, Simon, and speak soon.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Dan. Thanks very much. Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program.
In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose. And for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWAP member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAP members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.